Okay.
All right, it's another edition of the Edgington Post Show. Today I have with me, once again, Tim Pichot. Did I have that right, Tim?
You do, Tim Pichot, so sort of a hard T at the end.
Okay, terribly sorry. Tim Pichot and Liberty Advisor?
Yes, I go by the Liberty Advisor because I'm a financial advisor that believes in freedom and liberty.
And you had apparently on Free Talk Live made a prediction about sort of when the financial markets were going to begin falling apart, or, you know, like sort of how or what the, you know, whatever. You're going to explain it to me now. you did actually call into the show maybe a week, week and a half ago, 2 weeks, something like that, and talk about it. But I wanted to get a little more clarity on the issue. So please.
Yes. So what is going on right now in the financial markets, which is pretty big news that almost nobody is covering. And let me sort of back things up. So there's something called the repo market. And what happens is the banks need to have a certain amount of funds on hand every night. Some banks will have too much. Some banks won't have enough. And then what the banks do is they then lend money to each other. And usually it's right around the Fed funds rate. So, you know, until yesterday, it was 2 to 2.25. Then yesterday was the only the second time in 10 years the rates have been cut. So now it's 1.75 to 2%, which is that is what you'd expect to have to be the rate that the banks are charging. However, what happened Sunday night was that the rates, the interbank lending rate that got up to 10% on over the weekend. And so going into Monday, there were some banks that actually paid an annualized rate of 10% to borrow money overnight. And now contrast this with the fact that, you know, just a week or two ago, you could borrow money for 30 years from a treasury bond at like under 2%. But yet if you're a bank, they were charging each other 10% to lend money overnight. So wow. What the Fed had to do now what these banks could have done is they could have gone directly to the Fed, what they call the discount window, to borrow money. But what happens is if you're caught borrowing money, not caught, but if people find, there's basically a huge stigma to being a bank that has to borrow money. So no one wants to be the bank that goes and has to admit that they had to borrow money from the Fed. So what the Fed does is they basically give a free pass to all the banks and then say, hey, you know, we're just going to, I think on Monday it was, we're going to extend $53 billion of liquidity to the market. And actually, I think there was like $75 or $80 billion worth of demand. So they snatched that right up. Then
Hold on. So why do the banks need this $53 billion? Which banks are getting it? I mean, like, why do they need it?
Because there's a certain reserve requirement or reserve ratio.
People are pulling their funds out or people are taking more loans?
It's too early to tell what the exact reason is, but one of the things that happened over the weekend is that drone attack. I mean, who knows what really went on in Saudi Arabia, but anyways, supposedly the drone attack that hit that one large oil field,
right?
That then shot oil prices up 20%. So some of the speculation is that there could have been some banks on the wrong side of that trade, and now all of a sudden they had a fund or something blow up and they needed extra liquidity. Some other theories is that, you know, it was the time that the companies had to pay their quarterly tax payments. But, I mean, all that stuff is known well in advance. So it shouldn't have been – well, the tax portion of it is known well in advance, not the,
right, sure,
the drone strike. So nobody knows exactly for sure because the whole system is not very transparent. It's not on a public blockchain. So everything is sort of obfuscated in terms of how things actually play. But the bottom line is that some banks – need money. In this case, a lot of banks needed money. And actually, as of the last, I think, 3 days, it's been right around $75 billion and it's been oversubscribed. Like there's been more, there's actually, I think, about like 8 or 9 billion extra that the market needed. And so some people still had to go back out into the market and borrow money at 5, 6, 7%. And there's a huge stigma to going to the Fed. So what the Fed does is say, okay, we're just going to give it to everybody. So that way nobody knows which are the actual bad actors. And then it creates more of a moral hazard because if nobody knows what's going on within their bank and they know they're going to be bailed out, it means that nobody cares what their bank is doing. And they just blindly put their money who's ever going to give them the highest deposit.
But no one knows what their bank is doing and they just blindly give their money to whoever's going to give them the highest rate of deposit. I mean, that's what's happening.
And I don't know what year it was, but now the money that's at the bank is actually the bank's money. And it's an asset in the bank's balance sheet that if a creditor is owed money, they can take money from you. And I don't know the exact year, probably like 2010, 11, 12, during the Obama regime. They changed that law. So in your own money market accounts, it's the bank's money. And you just have to go, you know, I mean, in a lot of places, they're actually charging negative rates. So, I mean, I guess we at least don't have it here, even though the actual real rate.
As far as countries?
Yes, a lot of countries are, yeah, are negative right now.
So actually, negative rates, for those that don't know what they are.
Negative rates, it's pure lunacy, but you give the bank money and then you're guaranteed to get less money back. So most places in the world right now have negative interest rates. So you go to Japan or Sweden or Germany. Germany just issued a 0% bond, I think, for 30 years. And then you've got Trump out there saying, you know, that the Fed's clueless and we need to have rates below zero over here. But ultimately, you're destroying capital, which means you can't have capitalism without capital. And what was going on, all these companies and corporations are zombies. They can't survive. And so the only way they can survive is if they have to basically get paid to borrow money in some cases, like if you're Deutsche Bank or in the Europeans, they're actually lending it out to corporations too. So big corporations can borrow money at sometimes below zero or basically nothing. And then it promulgates and just extends out all this bad stuff that's going on. But what we've been told the past several years is that, you know, quantitative easing was just, you know, a temporary thing. We're going to be able to get out of it. You know, don't worry. And I got in trouble with the first investment firm that I worked at for trying to predict that the Fed could never get themselves out of the situation. And they read one of my emails, my compliance people, and like, you can't say that. And meanwhile, here I am. So what I just pulled up on the on our Zoom screen here is something called the dot plots. What the dot plots are is the Federal Reserve governors. So these are the people who are actually making the decisions, estimate on where rates will be both, you know, at the end of that current year, the next year, the year after, and then the longer term, so 3 years away. In 2012, the long run, which was 2015, it was about, you know, I'm eyeballing this now, but about 4.25% is where everyone thought the Fed funds rate would be 4 years ago. And I was saying there's no way that this could possibly happen, that this is fake news. There's no way, because if the Fed fund rates is 4.25, it probably means that the banks have to borrow at 5 or 6, or the country, the government would have to borrow money at 5. Even if they're only borrowing money at 5, that'd be over $1 trillion a year in interest. And how no one else could piece this together is sort of beyond me. Then skip forward to 2014, and they said, okay, you know, by 2017, we'd be at about 3.75, and that didn't happen either. And then you skip forward to December of 2016, and then we're showing that, which is right about now, it's showing that we should be at 3%, and yet we just lowered it to 2%. And this presentation was called The Trump Effect and Why Good News is Bad News. And this was made January of 2017. And so I'm not Monday morning quarterbacking this stuff that's going on. And I had a podcast December 28th called When's the Next Rate Cut? When late December, there was a 2% chance of the rates being cut. And one of the funny things that came from yesterday's press conference, not that like a Federal Reserve press conference is funny, but what they were saying is that they don't expect further rate cuts this year or next year. No chance of that happening. And then the other thing that
they said just very recently, they're not going to cut rates, and then they cut rates.
Oh no. So after they cut rates yesterday, they said they're not going
to happen again.
They don't foresee it happening again. And meanwhile, you know, the first rate cut they did, they said it was just a mid-course correction. Yeah. BS, a mid-course correction.
Yeah, so so they keep cutting rate, and they keep saying that we're not going to do that again. That sounds like somebody who's losing control of whatever it is that they're doing, right? Like, don't worry, I don't have to feed any more gas into the engine. I don't have to lean up the carburetor anymore. This is the last time I have to turn the screw. Well, you've done it 5 times now. I mean, how many more times are you going to have to do it? It gets a little nerve-wracking, and especially when, you know, it's something as important as the global economy.
Well, they'll just change the name. They won't call it quantitative easing this time. People are now saying they should just call it permanent open market operations. I forgot what major bank said that. But one of the other things Powell said in the press conference is funding pressures have no implication on monetary policy stance. I mean, does anybody believe that? That funding, that the banks needing money has no implications on what the Federal Reserve does in terms of their monetary policy?
I mean, they're basically the bank, and all the other banks are just franchises of that bank.
Yeah, and it's obfuscated in terms of who owns them. I mean, you basically probably have a big, you know, a few wealthy European families that own everything.
And I don't know who owns it. I mean, you know, I've tried to look it up. There's I know Bank of America is a member bank, but I don't really I don't know enough.
But then you don't know who owns Bank of America, and then but then it's obfuscated because then you have a bunch of different funds, and then who owns the money in those funds, or who owns the money in these hedge funds or mutual funds or ETFs. And so it's not, it's very hard to piece together. But ultimately, when you had guys like Rockefeller, when he passed away, should have been the richest person in the world, but he wasn't, because he was basically a front man for the Rothschilds, who are really, you know, front men for other people. You know, this gets in, I'm not sure if you want to go down that road. I certainly can. But one of the other things from the press conference is that Jerome Powell said, it is certainly possible that we'll need to resume the organic growth of the balance sheet sooner than we thought. The organic growth, like printing money, is now what he's calling organic growth. I mean, I kid you not.
Okay. Look, these are funny to you because you understand what the code language is. I barely understand what these people are saying.
That's what they want to use the most amount of words to say the least amount of stuff possible. And if they use, you know, big words like quantitative, like, oh, that sounds fancy. And
they lost me, right?
Yeah. And like, then it's like, oh, easing. Oh, easing sounds pretty easy. So we have a hard word with an easy word. And now we'll just call it, you know, because we can't just call it money printing, or we can't call it counterfeiting, or, you know, Zimbabwe. But, you know, but what is going on is that the Fed is losing control. So they can set a rate at 2%. But if the, and all that rate is the overnight lending rate if you go to the discount window. But nobody goes to the discount window because it's such a huge stigma to have to go to that. And so it's sort of like if you, you know, if you maybe are struggling in school and your parents don't want to put you in special ed because, you know, there's a stigma to that. And so, but maybe you need special ed to help you out. And so instead, the Fed is just giving everybody cover and just giving money to everybody. So that way they can't actually point out who the actual bad actors are inside of here. And so it's just, and at that point, why even have a discount rate if you're just going to do that? I mean, why even, and then the Fed, they don't even lend money, borrow money directly from the Treasury. What they do is they lend money to the banks, and then they borrow money from the, then they buy the money back from the banks. And so the Treasury lends money, let's say, to Bank of America at 2%. Then Bank of America will then sell back to the Fed at 2.25%. And then Bank of America gets to make that, you know, that 100%. Arbitrage for nothing, because it's actually illegal for the Fed to buy it directly from the Treasury. And it used to be illegal until World War I, I believe, to even have a national debt. And then it was illegal when the Fed was
World War I.
Or it was illegal for the Fed to basically have a balance sheet of buying treasuries, I believe is what was illegal at the time, because people were weary. They're like, okay, well, if we just allow a central bank to start printing money, then we know where that's going to go. Because
they understood what the dangers of a central bank are. We have lived in a world where the central bank has been relatively stable for our entire lifetimes, and pretty much the lifetime of anybody who's alive today. You know, relatively stable. I mean, obviously, there's been a devaluation in the currency, and there's been a few blips here and there. I mean, when I was in high school, I remember the rate on my savings account was, I think it was 6% of my savings and 5.5% on my checking. You know, the idea that you get 5.5% in a checking account. Good Lord. You know.
And now, so, if you keep your money in the bank, I mean, I've been calling it, you're going broke safely. And unfortunately, even though they're keeping things stable, even if you only have a 2% inflation, which we all know the real inflation rate is higher than that. I wrote a book on how they rig these things. But even if you have 2% inflation, I mean, you're eroding the purchasing power of the average person. And most of these jobs that have been created, you know, really, I think I saw something the other day where the past 20 years, the economy's only been averaging like 10,000 what they call breadwinner jobs a month. And they define breadwinner jobs as $45,000 or more. So, I mean, most of these extra jobs that are created are, you know, if you got, let's say you used to make $100,000 a year as a, I don't know, as a Federal Reserve economist, then they fire you because maybe you're actually the only one that knows what they're doing over there. So now you've got two jobs. Now you're a waiter and you drive Uber. Well, now it counts as two jobs to the economy versus one. So even though you're making a lot less money, the numbers now look better. And so that's just only one of the many ways. But ultimately, you are eroding the purchasing power. And if most people in America are getting, you know, these crappy jobs, well then, and then their cost of living keeps going up and up and up, everyone then is attacking the symptom of, oh, we need to have $15 minimum wage, when the actual problem isn't the $15 isn't that they're not getting paid enough. It's that everything they're buying costs more and more and more, and it's cost more and more and more because the ultra rich and the Federal Reserve and the people that own the system are the ones that get the money for nothing or next to nothing or pretty soon maybe even below nothing, and then they get to buy up all the assets, and so now it becomes a renter, like a serfdom. So I mean, Friedrich Hayek,
Can you predict, and I understand that's dicey business. You did it though, right? Like you said that the economy is going to begin coming unraveled when the Federal Reserve loses control of the interest rate. What interest rate?
Yeah, so I mean, the Fed can set any interest rate they want to, but that only affects the discount window. And so generally, right, when they lend money overnight to each other, it's pretty close to that rate, but they can't technically control the 30-year rate or the 10-year rate, but they can.
That's why they've crossed here. The short-term and long-term rates have crossed a few times in the recent past, which is often the indication of a recession that's coming on. But people are like, well, I don't know, the stock market went up a few times, as though the stock market indicates a recession. It gets very complicated.
And technically, I'll make a crazy statement that you could technically never have another recession again. And it's very easy. I mean, now people, I might have lost people. They're like, oh, but he's crazy. Well, listen, well, you understand where I'm going with this. A recession, the technical definition of recession is two negative quarters of GDP. So what if you know that, okay, well, we're having a bad GDP number, so we'll just go spend $1 trillion to go bomb Iran. And now we've added $1 trillion to our GDP. And even though, we're a lot worse off and our grandkids are now in debt and our great-great-great-grandchildren are now in debt and they're trying to float 100-year bond ideas out there, but everybody's worse off for it, but you technically could avoid recession because you just printed $1 trillion. Now, eventually that will catch up to you and we're just going to fall off a higher cliff. Just keep raising the cliff or lowering the water, and pretty soon we're going to do a high dive into the kiddie pool here. But there's so many different ways that they can rig this in terms of buying bonds. And so if they start buying long-term bonds and they artificially manipulate things, but ultimately the more they get themselves into this mix, the deeper they're in it, and they can never get themselves out of it. Once you
just hire Arthur Anderson to do their accounting and whoop, they're there, no more recessions. And so, you could be in a recession without ever knowing you're in a recession. If the United States government decides, well, we're going to do that socialized medicine thing because it's civilized and the rest of the world's doing it, and you don't want to be behind the rest of them. And I mean, at that point, they just dump money into the medical area. Well, let's raise some prices here. And they can just pencil whip everything. They don't have to have a war. As a matter of fact, with the Pentagon could just buy more tanks. There'll never be another tank war in our lifetimes. I mean, it's just we've moved beyond that. My prediction is final tank war for the United States occurred in the Persian Gulf when they caught some Republican guards sitting out there and they just blew their tanks up, half of them, killing half the people that were around.
Well, now the tank wars are going to be when now your local police department has those tanks and they're coming from gun owners will be where those things go. But I would actually argue that we pretty much never got out of recession if you actually had real data. And this is just such a complex issue. What your listeners can do is if they text the number they would text is 71441, and then in the body of the text message, if you just write Liberty Advisor, one word, so Liberty Advisor, it will then send you out a copy of my book called How It's Rigged the Economy. Because what you have to understand is that, all these numbers play into each other. So the GDP numbers are affected by the inflation data. So if you fudge the inflation data, so let's say the GDP is 4 and the inflation is 2, then the GDP print would come out at 2%. So they take what the real GDP is minus the inflation, and then that's where your final GDP number comes at. But what if the real inflation rate is 6 and the GDP grew at 4? Then you're at -2. And so what I would actually surmise is if you go to like a website like shadowstats.com by John Williams, he actually has the numbers of how they calculated the inflation back in the 80s, the 90s, and then presently. And what you'll see is that, this is using the government's own numbers, is that they constantly rig these numbers to then make them appear better. And so there's lots of different ways to do that, both on the unemployment numbers, both on, on the inflation data, on the GDP data. It's rigged 7 ways to Sunday. So let's say, I'm holding my calculator, but let's say it's an iPhone The new iPhone, let's say the new iPhone costs, you know, 30% more than the old one, just making up a number here. What they'll say is, oh, but it's 50% faster and it's 50% better battery life. So even though it costs 30% more, it's actually a 20% deduction. And actually the cost of living is going down. I think they call that hedonic adjustment. And that's just, there's so many different ways that they rig this stuff. Or, oh, you used to buy a steak and now you're poor and you can only afford hot dogs. Well, now they put the price of the hot dog in, not the price of the steak. And then, or like, oh, well, you know, now instead of getting, you know, a box of cereal that, you know, is 20 ounces, now we'll give you one that's 16 ounces and say that, you know, there's no inflation. And so there's
cereals
in many ways.
Interesting. What is it going to look like? Well, so we know what's going on now. What's it going to look like in the future? This has got to be a very difficult question to ask, but, you know, can you give me sort of some general idea of what somebody might be looking for? And then probably more importantly after that, what the hell are we going to do about it?
Well, there's only really a couple of ways that this can...
I don't believe in what do we do about it, because we can't do anything. If the American public has demonstrated one effing thing over the course of the last century, is that it can't do crap, all right? I mean, nothing. It can do nothing. I can spur nothing to happen. However, I can do things for my family and me, and I can make an action myself. But trying to get my neighbors to agree, no, can't do it.
Well, a lot of times it'd be better if they just did nothing, because usually everything they do is, it just makes it worse. And so that's why you had Paul Warburg, who is the creator of the Federal Reserve System, said we shall have a one world government by conquest or consent. And so they're going to try to get the people to consent and ultimately have a digital cashless society where they can, they can't really enforce negative interest rates when you still have, you know, $100 bills floating out there. And so they ultimately want to have somebody on like a Libra like system, but have, you know, they, them, those control it, and not, you know, not Facebook, not that Facebook, I mean, we all know Facebook is, you know, a CIA front pretty much allegedly through LifeLog, but where things are going is, you know, there's really only a few different ways things can go. I mean, if you had natural market forces, you'd probably see a big market crash. You'd see the interest rates go up, big market crash. But since we don't have a natural market, I think that the most they're willing to allow the market to go down is 20%.
And this is the stock market?
Yeah, the stock market. And okay. So what they can, specifically the S&P 500, I don't think they'll let it go down by more than 20. And
is it possible for the S&P market to get so overvalued, the S&P stocks or whatever, that their price gets so overvalued? Because what people don't understand is that they've been they've been buoyed by this notion that everybody can make money if you just get an S&P 500 matching fund. I mean, that's it. You'll make money. You'll get 6 or 7% per year, 6, 7, 8% per year if you just get a S&P 500 matching fund. No problem. Long story short, what that does is, well, everybody who's on the S&P just sees this money flowing in as far as, stock price goes. Stock price keeps going up. Well, it can't just keep going up. That's what we have corrections for, to bring it down to a correct number. I suspect what we're going to see in the not too distant future is that the S&P is going to have to, something has to give. You can only inflate a balloon so far.
Well, one of the interesting things is that you have to understand what you're valued in what. So if you're devaluing the dollar, you could very well have the S&P be at, yep, you know, a million, because you just keep printing more and more dollars. Yep. But if you price the S&P in gold, or price the S&P in Bitcoin or some other assets or commodities, or maybe even barrels of oil, what you'll see is that you'll probably, and this is, you know, obviously, I am a financial advisor, so everyone else has like a free pass to say whatever they want on here, whereas I am regulated by the SEC. So hypothetically, you know, no, this is just, you know, a crystal ball guess here, but, you know, hypothetically, you know, priced in these other assets, you know, I think that it will fall relative to gold and fall relative to Bitcoin, but relative to dollars, you know, if we start printing, Fed starts printing $3 trillion a year, you can see the S&P keep going up and up and up, and you're going to see ultimately your purchasing power is probably not going to be able to be maintained. And so it's a very tricky situation. I expect the Dow, but I mean, I'm young, I'm only 33. So I think by the time I'm 65, I think the Dow will actually be, I think there's a good chance it'll be over a million. And that probably sounds crazy, but if you think about it, you know, when I was born, it was probably 800, and now it's at, you know, probably close to 27,000. So, you know, but if you extrapolate that out, and the amount of money printing that's going on. I think the money printing will be more, not less. And I think ultimately this will lead to other countries getting off the dollar. You've already seen other systems being set up that are alternatives to the SWIFT system. The SWIFT system is how banks move money around. It all goes through New York. And so if you're, you know, any country besides America, you know, why are you going to want to put, you know, their most important asset, which is the price of money? Why are you going to let, you know, the New York Fed just have a complete dictatorship over this?
Right. I mean, if there's a financial crisis going on in the United States, the using the SWIFT system is the equivalent of using the Zimbabwean Central Bank to clear payments around the globe today. That'd be crazy.
It is. And so other countries realize this, and, you know, the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, they're setting up, I believe they've already set up alternatives. You're seeing, you know, Russia and China paying for things using the yuan. You're seeing yuan and gold backed oil contracts. So the yuan is the Chinese currency. It also goes by their renminbi. So there's a lot of crazy stuff going on. I think ultimately all this leads to eventually in a long enough time horizon of, you know, the dollar losing a lot of its value, and the dollar losing its value could mean the S&P goes up. So it's very hard to, it's a whole different mindset. And one of the things that's different this time than in 2008 is that in 2008, the average baby boom, the oldest baby boomers were just starting to turn 62. So they were actively pulling money from their accounts. And it's a big, big deal when you start pulling money from your accounts. And I think somewhere I actually have a slide that shows this. So let me just pull this up right this second. So what happens when you start pulling money out is if the market were to go down 20%, your portfolio goes down 20% and you're withdrawing 4% to live off of, you've got to go up 42% over the next 3 years to get back to even. If the market goes down 50% and you're withdrawing 4%, you'd have to go up 132% over the next 3 years to get back to even. Now, a lot of these pension funds have nowhere near the amount of assets based upon how they value the pension funds. And what they did in 2015, I can't remember the exact name of the act, and I only discovered this a few months ago, and I've actually never heard anybody else talk about this, is that the government passed a law. So here we are passing a law, and it was something like the 2015 Americans for Prosperity and Protecting Your Retirement Act or something like that, like very Patriot Act type Orwellian speak. And what it said was, is that how they used to value the bonds inside of inside of these pensions is what they would do is they would take they take a look at the LIBOR rate, which is sort of like the international Fed funds rate, if you will.
Right.
And the London interbank offering rate, they'll take that rate and extrapolate it out and use that as the interest rates for your bonds inside of your pension fund. Now it's a law, an actual law, that you have to use a trailing 25-year average. So what this means, Cliff Notes, is a lot of these pension funds are assuming 6% and 7% returns for their bonds inside of their portfolio that are not going to be earning that. If they are earning that, then it means. But really, everything is damned if they do, damned if they don't, every single way around. Because, okay, what if the rates do go up and now the pension funds are able to pay their bonds? What happens is for the bonds that they're holding, if you have a 10-year bond and rates go up 1%, it works like a teeter-totter. So if rates go up 1% on a 10-year bond, the underlying value of the bond loses roughly 10%. Rates go up 2%, it loses a little bit over 20%. And so it's fine and dandy if you can just live off your interest payment. But if your interest payment is 1% or negative, there's no way you can do that. And so you're going to have to pull from principal. And as soon as you start pulling from principal and you're down 20%, and you're not going to gain 42% in a bond over 3 years. And so it's just craziness, madness. And what we're doing right now to hedge people is we have, and I started running this.
This is your firm.
Yeah. So my firm, Innovative Wealth, I'm one of the advisors over there, is, you know, we had sort of seen all this coming last year when October 4th or 3rd last year, Jerome Powell, the Fed chairman, said that we're on autopilot and everything is great. And the day before he came out with that press conference, I actually listed all the reasons why there's no way that this could happen. So last year around this time, we were under the impression, the Fed Reserve was under the impression that they could sell $50 billion a month in bonds. And I'm like, well, first off, so you're going to sell $50 billion a month in bonds. Well, who's your biggest buyer? The biggest buyer of the bonds has been the Fed. And now you're going to become the biggest seller. How is that going to work? Oh, and then who's your second biggest buyer? China? Oh, yeah. Aren't we in a trade war with China? And then who's the third biggest buyer? Japan? Oh, Japan's the most indebted country in the world right now. First world
negative interest rates.
Yeah. And so I'm like, and then not only that $50 billion, then it's another $100 billion in to finance deficit. So you're going to have find $150 billion of buyers a month. And I was caught, I probably have 15 videos going back almost 2 years before this even happened, pinpointing that, because it was telegraphed when that amount would reach the pinnacle of $50 billion a month. So now not only are we not selling $50 billion a month, the past 4 days they've had to inject $75 billion a day. So we go from $50 billion a month selling to now $75 billion a day that they're buying. I mean, can I take a victory lap now and say that, you know, that I was right on this? And
nobody gives credit to you if you don't work for the government, pal.
Yeah. So it's just absolutely crazy that what is going on. And you see very little press on this, very little people are talking about it. I mean, yeah, Drudge is covering this a little bit here or there. But no, it's a bad sign when the banks can't even lend money to each other overnight. It means that some players are out there, you know, with major, major liquidity shortages, and they were willing to pay 10%. You only pay 10% if you have to pay 10%, you know, not because you feel like it or because you want to. And so, I mean, now the banks get to feel like us, where if you're, you know, your little guy out there, you've got to pay, you know, 16, 20% to borrow money. But if you're, you know, an insolvent big bank, you can borrow money for nothing. And so it's just basically a feudalism.
What do we do about it? What do I do to protect my family? What are the steps that people can take?
I mean, right now, I mean, probably trying to live below your means, make sure, I mean, the biggest thing is making sure you've got some sort of dependable income. Because when all this stuff happens, if you don't have to pull from your assets, and so different, there's going to be different things for different people. So if you're retired, that's going to be one set of things. If you're 20 years old, it's going to be another set of things. If you're, you know, 40 years old, it might be a different set of circumstances. Depends on everyone. I mean, I hate, you know, giving this, you know, kind of wishy-washy answer, but, you know, it's going to depend on exactly what your circumstances are.
The economy is going to take a hit, and whatever happens is going to be different than what is currently going on today. Somebody's moving the cheese in the near future.
Yeah, the cheese is being moved, and the cheese stinks right now. It's rotten, and there's no way that this can basically go on forever. And so I'm you know, what we're doing is we have some put options. And if you don't know what that is, I would not recommend you
go
out there really knowing doing this. Do not.
I immediately dismiss the notion.
Yeah, because it's very dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. But, you know, essentially it's as these go down, as the market goes down, the value of a put option goes up. So what we have is a quantitative finite amount that somebody could lose in a portfolio, because we were trying to protect against that sequence of return risk where it doesn't matter what your average return is. So people are like, oh, I average 10% a year. Well, it doesn't matter if you're down 30% year one of your retirement, because, you know, it's basically game over if you haven't planned for that. So I work with retirees to try to figure out plans where I stress test and we'll put in these type of scenarios and say, okay, well, what if the market is down 20% or what are different ways people can do this. And so it might be having some money on the sideline. And so when things go down, you can then use that money to live off of, or use that money to then buy other assets that have lost way too much in value, because there will be things that lose way too much in value next time. And I think ultimately the value on some of these things will be temporary, especially like an S&P 500, because my prediction is that we'll print so much money that it's not going to matter. But the big thing is that, well, what if it takes 5 years for the market to recover? Do you have 5 years to wait? Do you have 10 years to wait? You know, if you're 65, the answer is probably no. And so in that case, you know, you've got to have a plan of how to attack this. There's more than one way to do it, depending on how you're comfortable with. But I'd also recommend, you know, having a tiny bit of Bitcoin. I wouldn't go crazy if you know, don't know about it or haven't heard about it. And certainly, you know, stay away from the altcoins if you're new to all this stuff. You know, have a little bit in gold as well, and then have some cash on hand to be able to take advantage of whatever potentially could happen, because it ultimately is unpredictable. But, you know, what I would do is, you know, I just the other day got my YouTube and BitChute channel up with all my old stuff on there. And I made a little sort of like Peter Schiff was right video called Tempachut Was Right, where I went over the last 2 years of predictions, all the way from predicting Trump would win to then saying what would happen when he did win, and that the market would then, you know, go up. And then that would leave the Fed without an excuse to not leave the rates where they are. The Fed would then be forced to raise rates. That would prick the bubble. And then I was saying, hey, there's no way that they could then have this keep going on, and they would have to start lowering rates again. And I've been very contrarian, a lot of stuff, and not like I've been, you know, and I hate being the guy that's tooting my horn, but most 99.9999.
Nobody else is going to tell us. Yeah. You know, I mean, you know, people need to know this information. If you're providing better advice than the vast majority of people out there, you know, what else can you do?
Yeah. And if you aren't willing to, and I had one of my clients say, he's like, hey, if you can't promote yourself, then who's going to promote you? And so that's, but it's not to say, hey, look at me. It's just like, you know, if you are into Austrian economics and how the world actually works, and it, what got me down this whole rabbit hole is that I was in a class that won the national competition on the Fed. It was called the Fed Challenge. Our actual saying was called "In Fed We Trust," was the actual class saying in 2008. So here I am learning about the Federal Reserve and, you know, the propaganda version. And then one day I hear a guy who looks like Rob Zombie tell me that the Federal Reserve is private. I'm like, you're full of crap. There's no way. Next thing I know, I go research all this stuff, watch Freedom the Fascism, then read Creature from Jekyll Island, realized that this guy who looked like Rob Zombie was right all along. And I realized if I was in the class to win the national competition against Harvard, Yale, MIT, and I have a Series 7 stockbroker license and a Series 66 license, and I'm on my way to becoming one of the youngest people in America to become a certified financial planner, and I didn't know this, well, then who the hell does know this? And it lit a fire under me to then spread the word to other people, because I knew that this was the biggest scam ever in the history of the world. And that's why behind me, I have a sign that says King's Ransom to try to initiate conversation with people that don't know this stuff, because they'll ask me what it means. And it's to show that we have the king's money, the crown's money, and our money is privately owned. And if you don't own your money, you are a slave. And the reason we're a slave is because the very first dollar that was ever lent out had 4% interest on it. So if you lend that $1, the end of year one, you owe $1.04. But how do you pay back $1.04 with $1? You've got to borrow another dollar and then another dollar. And then so from day one, we're basically in this high-tech bondage. I mean, they sell bonds. The root word of bonds is bondage. I mean, and even the root word of mortgage comes from French. Mort is death contract. And so, just educating yourself. I used to spend a lot of time trying to fight the Fed, you know, trying to, end the Fed, big Ron Paul guy. And then I realized, you know what? The best way to ultimately end them is to help promote cryptocurrencies and things like Bitcoin, because, and again, very speculative, still early days. And so, you know, obviously don't go putting all of your money into Bitcoin, because, you know, it's super volatile and we're not there yet in terms of being a currency. But ultimately promoting decentralized currencies is doing more to end the state and to end their monopoly on money, because the Fed's going to end itself. I don't need to go there and somehow end it, because it's not going to work. But they've gotten themselves into way too much of a hole. They're like an alcoholic who's had way too much to drink. They, instead of having, 30 beers a night, they cut it down to 5. And then they realized that they had to, start taking, another 10 beers a night. And that's where we're at. And even the former, you can find a video of this, the former Dallas Fed chairman, Richard Fisher, about 2 years ago on CNBC, and you can actually find this on YouTube. He said, right now, the Federal Reserve has been getting by on heroin and cocaine, and right now they are subsiding on Ritalin. And so this is the former Dallas Fed chairman saying this on CNBC, not me. This is the former Fed, and he talked about when this was in response to QE ending. So we found out we can't just get by with Ritalin, and so now we need to go back to more of the heroin and cocaine. And this is
using heroin and cocaine to describe their own problems. That's terrifying.
Yeah, and if you give me a minute, I can actually go and find the clip. But it is actually crazy.
Well, so it sounds like, good luck, everybody. It's going to be a wild ride here in the near future. Try some gold, try some crypto, call Tim. By the way, how do people get a hold of you?
You guys can go to my site, and it's thelibertyadvisor.com. Still making some adjustments to the site, but there's a work with Tim section where you guys can schedule a free consultation. I'm happy to be able to help as many people as I can. Right now you will get a hold of me. We are bringing on some more people later on, actually in like a month or two. So I can't guarantee if you in 2020, it's going to be me on the initial call. But for right now, I'm, willing to, give everybody a little bit of help, however they can need it. I know that they're going to benefit some way. It's tricky stuff. And basically I feel like I'm the guy in terms of knowing, I'm a libertarian, so I know exactly, the issues that are out there, and also, the things to watch out for, having a lot of experience in the financial markets. I started my first day in the market was actually the day Lehman Brothers crashed, believe it or not. So I'm very well aware of things go down a lot faster than they go up.
So things went well. Okay.
Yeah. But I was managing money in 2008 for my school and had the entire financial section in cash going into the crash. So I did, so it's not like, I was you know, so it was good timing starting the day the market crashed, because, you know, I couldn't have blamed me because I was out of it. But the fund that I was specifically managing the financial portion of it and put the entire thing into cash, and that's on record, in late 2007. And it got my butt chewed out by everybody. And all the guys who inherited my fund, they all got, you know, they were on like Money Magazine with money, fake money raining down on them, and now work for the New York Fed. But good times. Yeah, thelibertyadvisor.com. I also have a podcast that's on all the different channels. You can also find me on World Alternative Media YouTube channel, although a lot of shadow banning going on. So I would, you know, recommend people check out my BitChute. Because, you know, YouTube, I'm only there to try to get the average, you know, slave that's still on there. But, you know, but ultimately, you know, decentralized platforms like BitChute, or if you want to, you know, catch me on a podcast that way, or DLive too. That's how I listen to Free Talk Live a lot, is through DLive. And that you get nice notifications on your phone. So I would recommend decentralized solutions as much as possible.
Tim Pachote, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Okay. Stop that.